Free wine, I mean, what the hell?
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go and get started. Called to order the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here. We have a number of bills that we're going to be taking public hearing and possible work sessions, depending on the bill and the situation. So why don't we go ahead and start at the top of the agenda with HB 2111A. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2011A revises the standard for determining whether a person is substantially limited in major life activity for purposes of employment discrimination. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, wonderful. So we have a number of people who'd like to testify today. I'm going to go ahead and just ask Elizabeth Kushwa and Bob Junda to please come forward first.
Good afternoon, Chair Prozanski, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Kushwa with the Bureau of Labor and Industries.
And just to set the record, it's still morning.
What did I say?
I said good afternoon, at least that's what I thought.
Oh, my gosh.
She's on East Coast time, man.
And it just switched. Well, yeah. Not quite.
And another cup of coffee.
Actually, it'd be London time, wouldn't it?
Anyway, okay. My apologies.
That's got it right. The day goes fast.
Let's try this again. Good morning.
Good morning.
Senate Judiciary Committee. This morning we're looking at House Bill 2111 with the A amendment. To give you a little bit of background, this bill is simply to conform state and federal language and intent around what constitutes a disability for our civil rights laws. In 2009, Oregon amended these statutes to conform with the ADAAA, which is the Americans with Disabilities Act, as amended. And that indicated that individual has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more major life activities of the individual. However, Oregon added the qualifier materially restricts. When it did this, it raised the standard it would take for someone to be considered disabled. In the federal law, it violated congressional intent. As you know, I'm sure you've heard plenty of times in this committee, you can go bigger than federal law, but you can't go smaller. We assumed at Boley we could take out the word materially and fix it at the suggestion of the Association Oregon Industries. They wanted the exact federal language, and so that's what the A amendment represents. An impairment need not prevent or significantly or severely restrict an individual from performing a major life activity. However, not every impairment is considered a disability within the meaning of this section. And that, for clarification, is like the eyeglass exception. So not every impairment. If you have eyeglasses, your eyesight is impaired. However, you are not disabled. And so this just cleans up the language between the feds and the state.
All right. Bob?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. We're supporting 2111. Ms. Kushwa did a very good summary of the bill. The basic, I guess what I would put on the record is to repeat that the intent of the bill, and I think the effect of the bill, was to make state law as consistent as possible with federal law in this area, and I think it accomplishes that.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. So I also have J.L. Wilson. And J.L., would you mind bringing your special guest up with you?
Yeah.
I'm going to ask J.L., I think.
So for everyone today, I guess, is bring your child to work day.
Yep.
And so we've got a special, special guest today.
J.L. Thank you, Chair Prozanski and members. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. This is my stepson, Johnny Withers. He's a third grader at Kalapuya Elementary.
Oh, wonderful.
And he's the competent.
Well,
half of our
we'll hear from him after you speak.
Sounds good. AOI actually supports House Bill 2111. Just to take you through some history, we opposed the bill in the House in its original iteration, and Ms. Kushwa was right. Oregon had a higher bar for what constituted a disability in our statute as related to federal law. We felt that it was not an issue of simply deleting the word materially because we felt that that lowered the bar. Our suggestion was, and it's in the A and Gross version of the bill, to simply import the federal language from the EEOC regulations, which is what you have in front of you. I agree with the proponents that this makes the bill as consistent with federal law as we can get it. That's always been an aim of AOI, to get consistent state and federal regulations. So in that vein, we support the bill and just hope you pass it out.
Wonderful. Questions?
Yeah, I'm noticing, and all we're doing is conforming to federal law here, and I'm looking at all the no votes in the House. I'm wondering if those were related to your original opposition and something wasn't fully communicated, or do you have a sense of that?
I'm guessing that there was a, thank you, Senator Perzanski, Senator Cruz, that there was probably a sensitivity to that because this issue evolved. And I think on the surface, it looks like we might be lowering the bar. And what we're basically doing is conforming it with federal, and we have no issue with that.
All right. Johnny?
Hi. How are you doing today?
Something to do.
Hi. Well, thank you for coming today. So is this your first time to be in front of a committee?
Yes.
Well, you're looking like you're doing very well. Is there anything you'd want to tell us that we can help you or your friends at school as to helping schools or anything? Or
no.
And what type of sports are you involved in?
Football and baseball. Football.
Oh, wonderful. So are you playing baseball now?
Mm-hmm.
And do you have a favorite position?
First base or
second. I played first base.
That's a tough position.
That's a wonderful position to play. You don't get too many balls hit right at you, but you have to be able to stretch really hard.
You get a lot thrown at you.
Yeah,
so.
You do.
And remember, it's not the same as the catcher. I had a good friend in high school who they switched from catcher to first base because the first baseman got hurt, and he tried to block the base, got knocked out, and he thought, I do not like first base any longer. He said, they're coming at you at a different speed than they do. He said it was the weirdest thing he'd ever done. So they get me back to the catcher where I belong. But first base can be a tough position. That's great.
So have you had the chance to go up to where the gold man is, up on the observation deck?
No.
Oh, you should take...
He, believe me, I get asked frequently.
Yeah, it's a great trip if you can get up there.
It is a great trip.
And you get
it might be difficult for your dad, right. So you might have to
go slow. Well, thank you for being here today.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Jalen. Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2111A? Not seeing anyone, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing. And do we have all the paperwork?
Yes, we do.
And then I'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2111A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2111A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Close moves House Bill 2111A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And just for the record, Senator Dingfelder is out today. She's excused from all of our votes. Anyone like to carry it?
I don't think I've had one.
All right, Senator Roblin will be the carrier on 2111A. We'll close the work session, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing. This will be on House Bill 2562A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2562A updates rules to facilitate the development of electronic court processes, clarifies the Chief Justice rules govern all type of court records, removes requirement to maintain separate probate case information, designates the electronic copy as official court record, updates laws that govern filing transcripts, clarifies transcriber cannot charge an additional fee for electronic copy served on a party, declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Bruce Miller is here to give testimony. Bruce is coming up. Is there anyone else who will want to give testimony on 2562A? Bruce, when you're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Miller. I'm Senior Staff Counsel in the Office for the State Court Administrator. Thanks for giving us an opportunity to present House Bill 2562A on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department as we move the state court system from a paper-based system into an electronic-based system. We have identified statutes that we thought could be amended to better fit with the electronic world, and that's what this bill is meant to do. Section 1 clarifies the Chief Justice's rulemaking authority for electronic applications, that it covers all of our records, not just items that are filed in a case. So that would include our administrative records and our jury records, among other things. Section 2 removes an old requirement that required us to have a separate probate index. All of that same information is already filed in our case management index. It's a duplicative requirement, so there's no need for it. If someone wants to see just probate cases, we can certainly query that, so the information remains available. Section 3 clarifies that that we can batch scan documents in a case file as we move from the paper-based world to the electronic-based world, and those courts that have started Oregon eCourt, we need to transform all of those documents from paper to zero and one, and this makes it a little more efficient for us to do that. Sections 4 through 8 deal with the filing of the electronic filing of transcripts on appeal. So this is how we are moving transcripts from the circuit court up to the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court, and we've done that for a few years now because we've had e-filing in the appellate courts for a couple of years now. What we discovered as we were going through that process was that the transcript statutes work well in a paper-based world. They don't fit very well in an electronic world, so those sections are meant to clean those statutes up so that they work well with what we're doing at the appellate level. Section 9 deals with captions. It has an emergency clause, and we'd love to have this bill go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Bruce, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2562A. And colleagues, this bill is going to be held in for a little bit. It just happens to have a relating clause that we may need to use later. So we'll bring the bill back at some point before we run out of time. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2570A. And I guess before I just to let everyone know, we have told the courts that we were going to potentially be holding the bill for a little bit of time. So we'll open up the public hearing on 2570A.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 2570A modifies the method for receiving attorney fees in protective proceedings, designate when the court approval is required or not required before payment to persons in a protective proceeding. States Oregon Rule Civil Procedure 68 does not apply. Prohibits reviewing court from overturning an attorney fee except on finding of abuse of discretion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have Mike Schmidt from the State Bar. Mike, why don't you come on up? Is there anyone else who would like to give testimony today on 2570A? Mike, when you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Mike Schmidt. I'm an attorney in Washington County. I've been practicing for about 35 years, most of that time handling a significant number of protective proceeding cases. I'm here today as the legislative chair for the elder law section of the Oregon State Bar. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2570A relating to protective proceedings. Protective proceedings are those cases brought before the court when someone believes that someone is incapacitated and needs a guardian to protect their person or a conservator to protect their assets. Attorney's fees and costs have always been considered a legitimate expense to be charged against the assets of a protected person. A protected person, of course, is someone over which the court has appointed a guardian or a conservator. Because those proceedings are for the benefit of the protected person. The elder law section got interested in amending this statute 125.095 because there were some attorneys that felt that the rules of general civil court regarding attorney's fees applied to protected proceedings. That is a problem if they do, because those rules, known as Oregon Rules of Civil Procedure, or ORCP, don't fit well with protective proceedings. General Civil Court rules contemplate a situation where a case has come to a conclusion, and then the courts deal with whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded and the amount of attorney's fees. Protective proceedings generally don't come to a neat conclusion. They're ongoing because of the need to deal with the affairs of someone who's incapacitated. And so they just don't fit very well with the ORCP. So we wanted to make sure that the ORCP does not apply to attorney's fees provisions in protective proceedings, and that the procedure for determining attorney's fees fit with protective proceeding framework. And we believe that House Bill 2570A engrossed does just that. While we were looking at those issues, I wanted to tell you that we came across a recent Oregon appeals case called In re Durkach. In that case, it was decided that attorney's fees for representing a respondent in a protective proceeding could not be awarded. Now, a respondent in a protective proceeding is someone against who has been alleged they need a guardian or they need a conservator. It hasn't been determined yet, but it's been alleged that they do. So that at that point, they're just called a respondent. If a guardian or conservator is appointed for them, then they become a protected person. So if, in fact, the statute said that attorney's fees could not be awarded for the representation of a respondent, that made judges and attorneys concerned that it would be difficult to find attorneys who would be willing to, as a rule and all the time, represent a respondents before they became protected persons. So the statute deals with that by simply adding respondent to the list. Prior court approval in our in the statute is required for all attorney's fees. That's the way it's been. But we added a couple of exclusions. Services for matters unrelated to the protective proceeding that were incurred before the protective proceeding was commenced. For example, let's say a conservator had a apartment building and they had initiated an eviction proceeding against a tenant prior to the protective proceeding being commenced. That's unrelated to the protective proceeding, and that attorney's fees should not be involved with in that sort of case. Also, attorney's fees for attorneys acting as mediators in protective proceedings. We felt that those were not something that really should be subject to the court approval. The other section of the bill deals, particularly Section 3, deals with the standards that the court should use in determining, number one, whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded, and then how much those attorney's fees should be. Again, several of the civil court standards don't apply to protective proceedings, so we felt that we should have a statute that is more particular to the situation. Section 2 deals with those factors that the court should consider in deciding whether to award attorney's fees. For example, did the proceeding or the actions of the attorney or the party that the attorney represented benefit the protected person? Was it really of a benefit to them? Or was the person actually pursuing some sort of self-interest in the case? And were the party's positions reasonable in the proceeding? There's other things as well, but I thought I'd mention those three. Then if the court decides that attorney's fees should be granted, then in paragraph 3, the determination is how much. So they go back over the factors under the first section as to whether or not attorney's fees should be awarded, and then we add some more factors for the court to consider. Primarily, I wanted to draw your attention to subparagraph F, that the amount of attorney's fees requested are relative to the size of the protected person's estate, because we have situations where people pursue matters that maybe shouldn't be pursued, or they should give some consideration as to whether or not the assets of the protected person really relate to the work that's being put into it. So with those, I thank you for letting me testify. If you have any questions, I'm free to answer.
Thank you, Mike. Any questions? Thank you very much. When I saw your name on the registry, we actually have an individual working for us by the name of Mike Schmidt. And I was going to say, I thought he might have been two-timing for the, and moonlighting for the bar, because he does more criminal prosecution work on the outside. I'm going, wait a second, I don't know if he can be before us. But thank you for coming.
Thank you, Chairman.
Really appreciate it. All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2570A. And I believe we have our paperwork, so I'll go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2570A.
And Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2570A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 2570A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. So this just happens to be an attorney bill. It just happens to be one dealing with attorney fees. It happens to do with what I would consider regulation of attorney fees. And I think the chair will be carrying this bill unless someone else wants to carry it.
No.
Didn't think so. The chair will be the carrier on this.
Dingfelder asked yesterday.
You know, I actually gave that some thought, but, you know, I will never live that down. So know, the chair will carry that bill. All right. With that, we'll close the work session on 2570A. We'll open up our last public hearing for today on House Bill 2573A. Anna?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. 2573A makes acting as an immigration consultant an unlawful trade practices act violation unless the person is an active member of the bar or authorized by federal law. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. We have Helen Hirschbill and Aaron Knott. I want you to please come forward. And while they're coming forward, is there anyone else who would like to give testimony today on House Bill 2573A? And who is going to lead off?
I am.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, thank you so much for taking the time today to hear this. My name is Helen Hirschbill. I'm general counsel for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors in support of House Bill 2573A, a bill that provides a remedy under the UTPA for the unauthorized practice of law in immigration cases. ORS 2.80 prohibits a person from acting as an immigration consultant for compensation unless the person is an active member of the Oregon State Bar. In essence, it prevents the unauthorized practice of law in the immigration context. And the Oregon State Bar has the authority to enforce this prohibition by bringing a civil lawsuit for injunctive relief against any individual whom the bar has reason to believe is engaging in the practice of law as an immigration consultant in violation of that statute, ORS 9.280, excuse me. Unfortunately, over the years, the bar's enforcement efforts have been frustrated by a lack of resources and by limited sanction and authority. Even when the bar does obtain injunctive relief, it can only enforce that judgment through civil contempt remedies. We have no ability to seek any kind of criminal contempt or any punitive damages or any civil penalties. And limited enforcement in the immigration context is particularly troubling because it's an area in which unlicensed individuals frequently take advantage of particularly vulnerable citizens and provide ill-advised advice to clients that has very far-reaching and incredibly damaging consequences, which I think that the Department of Justice is going to speak to a little more detail. So in an effort to improve the enforcement options, the Oregon State Bar has introduced House Bill 2573A. which explicitly provides that acting as an immigration consultant, as defined in ORS 9.280, is a violation of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. It's our hope that including the practice of law by immigration consultants as an unlawful trade practice will increase the likelihood that victims are able to recover their damages through private enforcement efforts. In addition, this bill will make it easier for the Department of Justice to bring action against unlawfully practicing immigration consultants, and remedies available to the Department of Justice include significant civil penalties. With more enforcers and expanded remedies, the bar is hopeful that House Bill 2573A will provide greater protection to the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Aaron?
Thank you, Chair Prezonsky, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice here in support of House Bill 2573A. The Department of Justice does have primary enforcement jurisdiction under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, but more why I'm here. Part of the function of our having jurisdiction under the UTPA is we have a hotline that acts as the front line for taking consumer complaints across the state of Oregon. So we've noticed an uptick significant enough that we felt we needed to appear in this area. The fact pattern you see most frequently goes something like this. So in the United States, a notary public has limited certification powers, but in Central and South America, notario publico is something much different. They're well-trained, highly certified, and they're sort of your front stop, storefront for getting basic legal services. You need a contract drafted, you need a will drafted, that kind of advice. You would go to a notario publico, which of course sounds just like a notary public. So we're seeing a pretty profound growth in notary publics or notario publicos giving immigration advice without any sort of certification or licensing here in the United States. In the best case, that's somebody who doesn't have a law degree doing their best to provide advice. In the worst case, it's basically a scam where they take the money and there's no recourse left to the person they're taking it from. The consequences of receiving bad advice in the immigration context are very severe. It can be a large sum of money, but very frequently it's deportation. Sometimes deportation when you're being told everything was fine, all your papers were in order, and you find yourself swiftly and permanently separated from your family. So the Department of Justice does have a good capacity to work collaboratively with the Oregon State Bar in these sorts of complaints. We've done so before. They let us know when they hear about problem areas. We do the same, and we move forward with that enforcement jurisdiction. So this really will help us with that aspect of consumer protection. I'm open for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Senator Cruz first.
Thank you. Where it says, unless federal law authorizes the person, in what context does the federal law apply here?
I can speak to that, Chair Prezonsky, Senator Cruz. The federal law authorizes individuals on its own to appear before the UCIS, I think it's UCIS, is the name of the entity, to appear before it in the immigration context. And so because of preemption requirements, we can't, the state cannot not authorize somebody who is authorized under federal law to practice before the UCIS.
Okay. It's interesting. But they wouldn't necessarily have to be a lawyer.
That's correct.
It's a little complex as to, you know, the gifts and takes of what is or isn't required to have the license and what they can actually accomplish and do.
What sort of proceedings would we be talking about at the federal level that are different from what's contemplated here? I mean, this seems strange, just a little bit out of kilter to me that from the state perspective, you have to be a lawyer to practice law, and from the federal perspective, you don't. So I'm just trying to figure out if it's a different context that we're dealing with at the federal level.
Chair Pozanski, Senator Cruz, that it is a little bit different context. So the federal government, for example, specifically authorizes, it's usually non-profit organizations like Catholic Charities does a lot of immigration work that doesn't have a lot of money to hire lawyers to represent individuals in the immigration context, but they have very explicit requirements for training, and as long as people meet those requirements, then they are authorized generally it's under the supervision of a lawyer to provide limited immigration services, and it's just immigration services before the USCIS.
Senator Oberlin.
And wouldn't it also be true that there may be an attorney from another state who was offering it, and this bill is only about Oregon? You have to be in the Oregon bar, and they might not be a bar member who could be offering advice, or that not happen in the federal system?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Roblin, that may also be the case, that an out-of-state lawyer may also be allowed to provide immigration advice here in Oregon, notwithstanding the fact that they're not authorized to practice law. And again, it's a preemption issue. So,
and I just think, for the record, there's also, if an out-of-state attorney can make an appearance in Oregon, if they go through a special procedure, depending on, I think, what the context is, so they don't have to actually be licensed per se, but they have to go through the process to get that. Sounds like it's similar.
That's correct, Chair Pozanski. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2573A. Open up a work session on House Bill 2573A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2573A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Close moves House Bill 2573A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Close, you will be our carrier. That's all right. Thank you for volunteering on that, too.
Well, she did. She actually sent me the note, so okay. I should have said it differently, but
putting full disclosure in context. So before we end for today, today is Thursday. As you know, we do not meet on Fridays. Based on our workload, we will not be meeting on Monday because we don't need to. I know Senator Cruz and I talked about this earlier. I asked Anna to be so kind to kind of run some numbers for us, and this is what we have. Total number of Senate measures this year is 969. In 2011, we had 1134. In 2009, we had 1117. So you can see we're down 150 just filings in the Senate itself. The House itself had 1660 for this year, down from 1885. So that's 200 down. And then in judiciary for Senate this year, we have had 212 bills assigned to us. Last year, we had 304, so just under 100 difference there. Same thing for the House judiciary, and this year they have 252, and that's down from 355 in 2011. The other tidbits is in the totals for 2011 session totals. Apparently, there were 83 House bills in the Senate judiciary in 2011 that made it House to the Senate, and then so far we have 40. And then the Senate bills to the House judiciary in 2011 was 63, and so far they've received 23. So that's really the reason why we're not needing to meet as frequently. And so Chair has already given word to the President's office that we will not be meeting on Monday. So we'll be scheduled for Tuesday. We're currently scheduled, I believe, for 8:30, but we'll check to see what the what our agenda is and whether we will start at 8:30 or 9 o'clock.
I think we're all just getting tired. That's why there's less bills.
We're learning.
No, I think that it's the fact that people are recognizing that each of these bills costs money and they aren't all going to make it, so let's be more judicious. I hope that continues, because I think that's one of the issues we've talked about for the last 3 or 4 years, that, you know, do we limit the number of bills? And I think people were getting concerned that we were going to start actually at the leadership level saying you only get X number of bills. And I think people are recognizing that's not really what they want, so they're doing it themselves, which is really positive.
And Mr. Chair, there are some things we could do. For example, on the service animal bill, Senator Shields and I had virtually identical bills, and neither one of us knew the other one had it. And we can do some work in Ledge Council to allow our lawyers down there to inform me when I bring a proposal that somebody else has a similar proposal. I think we could, because there is a lot of duplication, and we might be able to cut down on that.
They do have a check on that, so you can do that.
No, you can. Okay. You can.
But it doesn't happen automatically.
It doesn't.
I think.
It's a lawyer-client privilege. I understand that, but there's got to be a notification process
that could work
that doesn't disclose, and I think that's something we ought to be looking at.
Well, you might go talk to Senator. You know, just a little note. Says, well, you might want to go talk to so and so. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think there's ways that could be done. Of course, better education within the members as to if you check the box, then you'll know. Second thing would be maybe having LC have the ability to say, there is someone else in the building working on this. Would you like to make contact with that person? They say yes or no. Yeah. Then you do the same on the other side. Mm-hmm. It takes a little time, but then you would be able to do it.
Yeah,
I agree.
All right. Any other thoughts for the committee?
We
solved that problem. Let's find a relating clause. With that, we're adjourned till Tuesday.